Hi, this is Against Everyone with Connor Habib. Friends, does it seem to you, perhaps as it seems to me, that people are talking about bizarre experiences of reality more often, whether it's synchronicities or just new weird thoughts, remembering strange dreams, having new kinds of pains, new images, maybe on the more extreme end, new sightings of strange beings, or on the more seemingly everyday end, a new openness to talking about tarot and astrology and witchcraft. I want to be careful here as I proceed, noting that I do think that there's an increase of that sort of thing. I'm going to be careful as I proceed to not fall into the Age of Aquarius sort of celebratory position. I have my reservations about all of this. And so I want to be careful about sounding like, as many people who talk and write about these things often do, that this is all great and good. And of course, you know, the flip side, the condemnation of it all is definitely not better. The condemnation of it from a religious, fundamentalist, or scientific viewpoint. If you've been listening to recent episodes, especially episodes 202 and 203 with the hosts of the Weird Studies podcast, Phil Ford and JF Martell, we talked a lot about the problem with magic. People seem to be turning to magic, turning to an understanding that these kinds of synchronicities and strange happenings as well are also just part of life, rather than trying to explain them all away as coincidence. And I think that some of that turning to magic and, we say, magical thinking or magical perspectives or witchcraft type perspectives on reality can bring along a lot of problems. And I talked about on those two episodes pretty extensively, so I'm not going to go into that here. But just to say, those problems are one reason to be wary and to not take up the celebratory position. But also, I don't want us to fall back into old concepts around all of this. What do I mean by old concepts? Well, not that old. I'm talking more about from the 60s into the early 2000s, where you have sort of integral studies, spiral dynamics, systems thinking. All of these ways of approaching that are not adequate, that are not up to the task anymore, if they ever were. So rather than talking about how we're definitely seeing an increase in all these strange happenstances and magical phenomena, let's instead talk about the fact that these experiences are filling the void that's been left by the old version of materialism's exit from the world stage. What we can say seems to really be happening is that there's an encounter with the dissolution of a version of materialism. I don't want to say that materialism is going away, just that old versions of it are being replaced with craftier versions, whether that's the subnatural VR experience, meta, digital currency, new kinds of trying to inhabit machines, life extension, and more. I talk about a lot of this on the last episode with Douglas Rushkoff and Diana Walsh-Pasulka. And that's one way that materialism will hold on. It will shift its form. But as it's shifting, people will start having these stranger experiences because there's space made for them. In that transition point, there's these little crevices and gaps and new openings. But there's also a real pathway, a real opportunity that's not just a small little aperture, but really a breaking open that's available to us. We could, rather than replacing one illusion with another and scrambling for whatever spiritual experiences we have that flare up to fill in the gaps, we could instead ask, what are the new spiritual challenges? What are the new spiritual tools we can use to meet those new spiritual challenges? What are the new spiritual responsibilities we have? And how can we take spirituality really seriously instead of just letting it be the weird stuff that sometimes happens in this new version of materialism? How do we engage with all of that without turning to old ways? Especially as my guest and I on this show discuss, when those old ways are culturally appropriated or just invaded over time again and again by certain types of misuse, how do we instead find the developmental gestures and living spiritual helpers for our moment? The efforts we need to engage with and relationships we need to develop to first help us even understand what's going on here, where we're at and what's happening, and then to move forward. The last time I had my guest Are Torsen on, this was episode 116, we talked about demonology and Christ and healing. It was one of the most personal episodes I've done, with lots of talk about my own spiritual experiences and Are's too. We just went all in with the conversation. And what else would you expect from someone like Are? Well, there aren't a lot of someones like Are. Are is an occult writer and teacher, but also a veterinarian and an acupuncturist. We talk on this episode about fundamental changes to the spiritual world itself and why some of the strange phenomena coming up and the shattering of the old form of materialism are happening. And the answers may seem very weird. They relate to fairies and evil beings that have a new access to us, and also a new archangel. I'll repost the introduction to episode 116 at the end of this episode, or a portion of that intro anyway, where I gave a definition of some of the terms if you're not familiar with them. So at the end of this episode, there's a little glossary sort of that will help you make sense of it all if you need some help. But just to say before we start that we do mention a set of beings called Asuric beings, which I think we explain well enough in the episode. I don't need to detail them here, but also this other being, Vidar. If Vidar is a recognizable name to you, if familiar to you at all, it's probably from the Poetic Edda, the long poem of Norse mythology, and the many stories that are contained within it, as well as the offshoot poems and stories from it. Vidar is the post-Ragnarok god. Vidar is the god that avenges the other gods by killing the giant Fenris wolf. Here's part of that poem. The wolf shall fell I, the father of men, and this shall Vidar avenge. The terrible jaws I shall he tear apart, and so the wolf shall he slay. I bring up another verse related to Vidar from Grimnir's sayings on the episode, and that can give you a much different side to him. The thing to remember here is that Vidar takes his position in the myth at a certain and crucial point. And another thing about Vidar is that, yes, he's armed, he has weapons, but there's a very special quality about this being, which is that he has power in a boot, a shoe that he uses to hold open the jaws of the Fenris wolf. Occultists, Western occultists, often talk about Vidar, and have been for a while, as the replacer of the Archangel Michael, who has advanced to a different stage of being. So Vidar is the archangel of our time, in a way, of this strange new world where the gods must be saved, redeemed, put back in their station in a certain way, and helped and assisted by us. Like I said, the last time I talked with Are, it was super revelatory and deep and weird and useful. This conversation with Are is no different. We talk about whether or not gnomes wear little hats, why people see Bigfoot in the U.S., why some people have to go through spiritual development, while others just receive flashes of revelation. We talk about fairy tales, particularly The Little Mermaid and The Elves and the Shoemaker, and how those relate to spiritual reality. We talk about spiritual hallucinations of assassins, and we talk about flat earthers. And it all starts with the question, what is white magic? Friends, I hope you enjoy the show. As always, this show does the best and I can do the most with it when I have support from listeners. Some of you support the show on Patreon. Thank you so much. For those of you who don't, it is the single best way to support this show by going to patreon.com/ConorHabib and pledging a certain amount of money, somewhere between $3 and $10 or euro are the most typical contributions. But some people pledge more. You get some cool stuff in return. But really, I just ask you to do it to be a part of this, to circulate in your warmth and care for the show into the actual process of it being made and the work that I have to do and the bills that I have to pay, including just posting it on certain platforms and distributing it and all that kind of stuff. It makes a big difference to feel that warmth and that love and care from listeners. Every episode of the show is free. You can support it in other ways, telling people about the show, giving this show a 5-star rating and a positive review on Apple Podcasts, sharing it on social media. You can even help the show by buying my novel, Hawk Mountain, because all my efforts contribute and support each other. They all weave into each other in one way or another. But I ask you at the beginning of this show to support the show on Patreon. Patreon.com/ConorHabib. You can pause and go there now if you'd like and do support the show. All right, here's my second conversation on Against Everyone with Conor Habib with Are Thorsen. Here we go. Hi, everybody. It's Against Everyone with Conor Habib. Welcome back, Are Thorsen. Hello.
Hello.
I thought we would start by discussing white magic and what it is. I have spoken a lot on the show lately about the problem with magic and how a lot of people, given the changes that have been happening in the world, seem to be turning more and more to using magic and thinking that that actually represents the right pathway out of materialism, but it does not, mostly because of the way people are engaging with magic. But white magic is something different, and I wanted to express that. So I thought we would start there, and I have my own ideas, but I thought you could tell me, you know, what your experience with, you know, understanding white magic is versus black magic or other forms of magic.
Magic is, for me, when you influence the material world, which is actually the elemental world, with your will or your intention. And what decide if it is white or black is depending on if you push your personality into it or your personal wishes. Let's say you try to use magic. We will later discuss how you can do the magic. But if you push magic, let's say, to personally get rich or get some benefits or take advantage of other people in the work or women or whatever, that is black magic. If you do it out of helping and not yourself, let's say you can help people have problems in breathing or suffocation, or you can look at nature if trees are suffering or animals are suffering or the world is suffering or the air is suffering or spiritual beings, if you use your magic to help them, or if asked to help, that is very important, then it is white magic. It has to do with you. If you override freedom, then you work into black magic. If you override their freedom, the methods might be exactly the same. It's not a different kinds of magic. Magic is your ability to influence the physical world, the so-called physical world.
Can you distinguish there, just before we go forward, because I think it'll come up later, the difference for you between the physical and the material?
The material is an illusion, and that illusion is created by the elemental world and the elemental beings. If you look behind water or air or atoms or molecules, there are elemental beings, and they are real, but they give the expression of materiality. Mm-hmm. So that is the material world, is actually, when we talk about that illusion, and the physical is more the behind, or the blueprint, some call it, or the copy. Mm. So the physical world, they have their laws, and the material have their laws, which can be bent, of course, if you really can do this magic, go into the elemental world and change something there, you can actually change the material world. Right. I have some very interesting examples on that. From when I was in America in August, I had a lecture tour in America. What happened there was, in the beginning, was pure magic.
What do you, go ahead.
Yeah, you see, well, I hope the American authorities do not listen to this. But you see, in Europe, you can travel. Because I've traveled quite much in Europe. And then it was enough to have had COVID and then one injection. And then I can travel as I wanted. I had the so-called green pass. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when I was invited to give this lecture tour in America, I thought it was okay. I had a green passport. So I ordered tickets, 10 air tickets and 30 lectures around and everything, and people had ordered tickets to get to where I was and courses and everything. And then I came to the airport of Norway, and I had even the boarding card. And and there was an American who said, "Stop, you are not coming in. We need 2 injections, and you have only 1. And I said, but I have everything. No question. I had to go home. They opened my, you see, in Norway, we have a health page where everything is written. So you can open my health page. I log in, and there everything that is done to me is written. So everything is there. Mm. So they open it, and they said, "No, you have only 1. So I went home. My wife was in shock. I came home. I should be gone for a month. And then I called my organizers. I had one in America, one in Canada, and one in Alaska. And they were also in shock. You know, everything was arranged. But I had a certain calm, so I went to bed, and then I slept the night, which I should have been on the plane, of course. And then in the morning, I opened the health page again, and then something had changed it, and it was written 2 injections, date, and everything. Everything was okay. I took a screenshot and I sent it to the authorities, and they said, "Welcome." And then I had to buy a new ticket, of course, so I lost, and that was expensive. And 1 day, you know, just 1 day. Same day, so I had to buy an expensive ticket. So, but I came to America 1 day too late and could do all. So, you see, these elemental beings, they wanted me to go and talk about them in America because it's very important to them. They want to be known, they want to be seen, they want to be acknowledged by human beings. So, they actually changed this, and this has happened to me many times during life, but this was so I could prove it because I had screenshot from before and after, and when I came home again, it was gone.
Well, it's, I mean, we may talk about this story a little later, but it's, you know, the elves and the shoemaker story, where the, you know, the shoemaker needs a lot more shoes made and he can't do it to sort of keep up with the bills and the taxes. And then he, you know, he wakes up one day and there are just a ton of shoes. And then he, at one point he goes down and he sees the elves making them for him happily. But then when he takes credit for it, that's when he, he loses the shoes. But we can talk about that maybe later. Cause I think with the Vidar stories and his shoe and his boot, I think there might be something interesting there. But I think when we talk about them, this elemental kingdom and working with it, you know, with this magical process, these magical processes, when I think about the difference between black magic and white magic, I'm thinking about people commanding those beings to do this or that on the one hand saying that the spiritual reality is there, it's real, but on the other hand having no problem commanding these beings to do whatever they want. And I think it becomes harder for people to think about what would happen if I just sort of gave in to those beings, if I gave myself a kind of nourishment or love or encouragement to them in the world. And so I was talking with a few other people on the show about this, and we thought, what are the practices going forward? And we had sort of come up with the vow, the prayer, and the congregation, that these are ways of encountering something that looks like white magic outwardly that allows you to, I mean, those can all go wrong as well, but that allow you to engage with the elemental kingdom in a way that's not coercive or manipulative in a time when that kingdom needs to be strengthened because its strength is being depleted by other forces and beings as well. When we come up with a way to engage with the elemental kingdom that isn't, it's not just about the intention, it's not just about I'm doing this to make money versus I'm doing this to heal someone or help somebody, but rather I'm not commanding those beings to do anything, I'm giving something to those beings, I'm giving something to that kingdom, is how I was thinking of white magic. But it sounds like maybe there's a bit of a difference there between what you're saying and what I'm saying. So the question is, how to engage with them without manipulating them, I suppose, because we also have to use them to encounter them.
When you see them, and that is the thing everybody will experience when they become aware of them or see them, you have immense power over them, and you do manipulate them, mm-hmm. whether you want or not, mm-hmm. just by observing them. But you have to keep a respect for them. You have to keep a love for them. You have to love and respect mm-hmm. and honor them, and then you can. You see, one thing that they want. These are beings who are trapped in the material experience. They are trapped in the materia, in the elemental world. And they want to be free. And the only way they can be free is to do good deeds. And if they you ask them to do good deeds, and especially, as Rudolf Steiner says, they want to be through Christianized. If you put this Christ force, which is actually love thy enemy, if you put that consciousness into them, they change. They grow in the breast area, in the heart area, and they become free, and they become sort of infused with morality. Because before you actually contact them or ask them to do anything or use them, they are unmoral, not amoral. No, amoral. They don't have morality.
Right. They're not immoral. They're amoral. Yeah.
Yeah. They don't have morality. They don't know what is right or wrong or whatever. And if you then infuse this love into them, which some can call the Christ force or love or morality into them, then they are so happy with that because they become free. It's like, let's say you have an animal. An animal do not actually have morality. You know, a tiger, kill this antelope. He doesn't pity the antelope, actually. He kills it. Or a mouse kills, a cat kills a mouse. So they are not free in a way. They have to follow their instinct. But if suddenly you give them morality, so they can choose, no, I don't want to kill this antelope. Because this antelope have two small babies, and I it's not right, I find another one. And then suddenly that gives a new aspect of freedom for this tiger. And in a way, the same with the elemental beings. They want to be free. They want to develop. Their next step is actually to get an I consciousness, mm-hmm. which means a moral consciousness. Mm-hmm. And when you give them that, they get very, very, very happy. So you have to use them, actually, to give them this.
Yeah. That's the trick, isn't it? Because that's the, I mean, it's all elemental beings everywhere. So you have to use them to access them. And so that's very tricky. But I think we will just move into Vidar, but maybe sort of slowly here, because my experience here in Ireland is very much that. So let me tell the story. So when you go to wells here in Ireland, sacred wells, you'll see so many times that people who are pagans will have tied, little bows and strings around the trees by the well. They'll have left these objects and so forth. And, when I first moved here, I thought, oh, isn't that nice? But the more I started going, I started identifying that this was perhaps for some people felt like the right path or the right thing to do, but I could notice that it was driving the beings deeper into the earth, the elemental beings deeper into the earth here. And I knew like they had to sort of hide there from the way that Catholicism and Christianity showed up in Ireland for a long time. It was good to keep them in the earth because then they could stay in the narrative. They could stay in the way that people spoke to one another. They could stay in people's experience of the landscape in a very particular way. But now the impulse of tying the ribbons and the pagan stuff around the wells is inappropriate, because what needs to happen is this, as you're saying, this new kind of attentiveness of Christ to the elemental beings, to the other world. And there are stories about this, even in St. Patrick's time, of the elemental beings, of the fairies saying, will we go to heaven on Judgment Day? And St. Patrick and his friends say, no, you won't. But that's changed now, I think. And there were saints also that were looking to redeem and save the fairies. So long ago, but the task wasn't ready yet. But this seems to me to be absolutely what is happening right now. And I do think that that very much ties into the Vidar presence. But maybe just to start from there, that this redemption or liberation or freedom brought to the elemental kingdom is necessary. And I wonder first to ask, why now? Why now is this necessary? When did that start to change?
Can you start with that?
Yeah.
One question is enough, you know. Because then you forget the other one.
Yeah.
So take one at a time. You see, 5,000 years ago, before 5,000 years ago, this spiritual world was open to human beings. And then something happened, and that is what the Indian calls the Kali Yuga. Mm-hmm. Spiritual world was closed 5,000 years ago. And that had to do, we had to find, you see, our identity, our freedom, our self-consciousness. So we had to go through this. It was closed. And then in our time, and the Indians said that it would last 5,000 years. The Indians, I mean people in India. And the Kali Yuga ended at the end of the 1800s. Mm. So then it started, the spiritual world started to open, accessible. And the first thing that became accessible was the superficial realm of the elemental world, where you have nature spirits, and especially like described in Ireland, you know, spirit of the source, of the trees, of the flowers, and so on. Of the bog, on everything. This opened. It isn't open in one day, but it was a process, of course. And then we could go there and meet these elemental beings, which is described in several books. Then, 70 years later, a deeper layer, or it maybe was a continuous process, but during the next 70 years, the next level was opened, the next realm. And during the next 70, the deepest realm. And that ended in 2019. Mm-hmm. Then the whole elemental world was open and we could travel there freely. So now we can travel there. And that opens a new path into the spiritual, which is the elemental path, which is also called the Nordic path of initiation. And now we can then access both the Luciferic elemental beings, the Ahrimanic elemental beings, and the Asuric elemental beings, and redeem them. Some say that it is impossible to redeem the Asuric. Some say it's difficult to redeem the Ahrimanic. Some say it's only possible to redeem the Luciferic. But I think it's possible to redeem them all. And so you say, why now? That is because these 5,000 years are ended now. We are now free to go into the spiritual world. And during these long time, of course, the spiritual world have changed a lot. And the one, and that is also according to Rudolf Steiner, the one who now sort of stands between the elemental world and the higher spiritual world is an archangel by the name of Vidar. And when, if you want then to meet him, you have to go through the elemental world, the three realms, and then you actually meet him. And when you have met him, you see he is the teacher of this new time. And then he starts his teaching, and you have to take it from there. Because I think this teaching is individual. He teaches you what you need to learn to go further, to proceed on your spiritual path. And for some, they know this, and then they have to learn that, or some know that, and they have to learn this, and so on. It depends on your work and how you deal with the world and everything of this. Then you get this teaching that is needed. And then you can proceed.
Yeah, it's interesting. Whenever I read your books, you go through so many steps of development, and some of them, you know, are recognizable to me. I emailed you ahead of this conversation just to say, you know, about this strange coincidence, you know, I mean, it's a silly word for it, but that I was having these dreams about these hands with eyes in the center of the palm that you could see, that could see into the material world and into the spiritual world differently than our own eyes. And then, you know, the next day I read it in your book or whatever, having certain experiences with my hearing. This is another thing you mentioned about your hearing and your tinnitus and being able to hear into the spiritual world through your tinnitus. And it's just important to say or reiterate, I think, what you said there, which was the individual character of it. You know, in fact, you go as so far as to write in one of your books, which other people have written, but you just say it very clearly, like nothing in the spiritual world is ever repeated because it's living. It has its own character. It has its own meetings with us and relationships with us. And so, but that is something for people to hear and take in, that sometimes people go through developmental stages through their own effort and spiritual development and work. And sometimes the same results or similar results or things that look the same will just happen to someone else without that. Why do you think it has that character where, you know, you've had this clairvoyant capability since you were younger, but these other things are hard earned. You know, I've had these strange experiences happen without really working for them or whatever. Sometimes, why is it staggered like that? How does it show up for individuals in that way? I think that would be really helpful for people to learn, because I think people really do still have, most people have an idea of a prescribed spiritual path that will render very similar results for everybody. And it's just not so.
No, it is not so. It is very different. Well, you might say it is not very different. Let's say you have a forest, and this forest, there is a river, there is a little mountain, there are trees, and so on, yes. And then we have 10 men, 10 people who want to go through this forest. Let's say this is the elemental world. Mm-hmm. And some go climb the mountain, you know, and come over there, and from the top of the mountain they can see a lot, and oh yeah, that's where I'm going. The other has to go through the forest, he has a compass, so we don't have to see, you know, that is the way. Somebody have to swim over the river, which is very different, get wet and cold maybe, and have to make a fire to get warm again. Maybe one actually drown in the river for that matter, or fall down from the mountain.
Or push someone down the side of the mountain. Or push someone, yeah.
So you see, there is so totally different are the stories afterwards and the paths. But still, if you are clever, you can hear that, oh yeah, because you ask this man who walked through the trees, well, did you see this mountain? Yeah, I saw a mountain there. And yes. And another one, oh, yes, I climbed it. And I was one went through around it. Or so you, it is actually the same story. It is the same landscape, but you experience is very different. So yes, it is both different and the same. So if you have walked there many times, you can recognize others and say, yeah, but I didn't experience this. Like you said, it came like this. And to me, yeah, that's quite understandable. And that is one version of the path.
It's, I love that you use the image of the forest, because there's this, from this old Norse text, from it's Grimnir's sayings, which is, if you have a friend who you deeply trust, go often to seek him out, for tussocks grow and long grass in Vidar's forest region. Mm-hmm. So I love, we go to meet, I mean, that's quite specific, and that's has its own mystery, that passage. But just to expand it a bit to what you're saying, you know, the friend we deeply trust, we go to seek him in the forest again and again, and we come back with something.
If you have walked, that is very important what you said, because if you do not, then the grass will grow high and the trees will cover the path. And what I've seen is, when you have gone into the elemental world and past Vidar and in the spiritual world and in the Devakanic world or the wherever you go, then the path is opened and you can walk there so easily next time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it also seems that others can then more easily walk there.
Yeah.
And that is the problem. There is a new book now, is called the Suffering Path of Rudolf Steiner, because in 1924 he gave this path into the spiritual world, but it seems that nobody was able to walk it. And then he understood after a half year that it was growing, if they didn't use it, it became closed. Because it was, in my opinion, too lofty or too spiritual. It was too advanced, you might say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so interesting that you say that. I was just last night talking with someone about what I was going to talk about with you today. And she brought up Rudolf Steiner and how he would give these... how he gave a path that was so advanced that most people couldn't get on it, or he would have these experiences that he couldn't really relate to people. So it's so interesting to me that this book is called The Suffering Path, because I said, I don't think it was that he couldn't relate, but that actually it caused him great pain to approach large groups of people. If he met with someone one-on-one, he was always able to give them the exact sort of right thing to do. But to meet large groups of people, I mean, you know, I'm sure you probably experienced this, but I, you know, if I go online and see people being cruel to each other, just out of turn, trolling each other, or whatever, I will experience that as painful for myself. Right. So when I can only, I mean, that's such a small example, or people gossiping, I can experience that as painful. So I can only imagine Rudolf Steiner in his development, a tremendous amount of suffering that he must have endured standing in front of large groups of people day after day, trying to express these spiritual experiences. And in fact, I think the one time he really says it is when he's giving the fifth gospel lectures, and he says something about being so pained, like, I know nobody's going to understand this, but I have to say it. And you can hear the struggle and the alienation and loneliness that he's experiencing. And I think Peter Zelig said once something like, or maybe he was quoting Steiner, but he said something like, you know, we must not be so naive to think that spiritual development will not bring great suffering. And that suffering often happens when you're trying to relate to others. But I do think a lot of what I've noticed myself doing is, yes, cutting the path and then putting the torches and the sconces along the way so it's illuminated so people can find their way behind me. But then it's frightening because I don't know if I'm always cutting the right path or a safe path for others. And just by virtue of it being public, like, you're an author, you have books out, you go speak to people. Just by virtue of it being public, people are going to try to walk down that path after you. And so you can turn and sometimes want to say, no, don't follow me. I'm still making my way. I'm still cutting the grass. I don't exactly know the direction I'm going. So how do you take care with that when you notice people following what you yourself are still learning? I mean, that can be frightening, I think.
Well, I have several now. I get feedback from several who are able to walk that path. See these things and talk with Vidar and it has been only positive. So I think this path, you know, the first part of the path, that is through the elemental realms. This path I started 60 years ago, so I'm quite sure about that path. Of course, if you have demons around you, you might see them and you might have frightened and such. But that's part of life. And you said, how do I deal with it? I am not that worried, actually. When I was 16, I said to my father, I want to hitchhike up to the northern North Cape and then through Finland and then through Sweden alone, 16 years old. And he said, yeah, that's good. Who would let their 16-year-old son go for a month around the whole Scandinavia? And of course, there were at least two times I could have died there. But I think I have too much that feeling that life is dangerous. Let people do their mistakes. I am not too careful. I am actually quite brave in many ways myself. So I expect others to be it too, maybe. So that is quite different from what some say. You must be very careful and you must guard this and you must be... I am not that careful.
Yeah, well,
and that you can criticize.
I wouldn't criticize. What I hear actually, and sort of knowing some of what you've gone through is that you've worked for a long time to resolve karmic debt. And because of the encounters with your own karma, it makes it sort of, it makes the path cleaner for others, you know, behind you. Because
you know, from what I've talked about with others and some, I mean, one of my lifetimes was not good. I did not do very, I did pretty terrible things. And I mean, so have
we all have. We all have.
And that's the thing that Rudolf Steiner, I'm going to get it maybe a little wrong, but he says something like, you know, for every step you gain in occult knowledge, take three steps to refine your person, you know?
Or more in morality, actually. One step in knowledge, you must take two steps in morality.
Yeah.
And if you do that, then you are, when you start to venture through the elemental world, then you have to, and you pay respect to the beings you meet there.
Mm-hmm.
You don't use them. You can play a little with them, of course, and you can ask them, can you help me with this? Or you can, I play for several years. I played quite much with the elemental beings. Mm-hmm. And then they helped me. And they even saved my life once. And when I was in Ireland, they showed me exactly where to go to meet my karma. So they helped me because I have a sort of playful attitude towards them, but I respect them. And I treat them as my equals in a way. I say, oh, hello. So that is important. That is the moral, I think. That is the moral. Because too many, they want to dominate these elemental beings. Like you say, you come to a source, you put up some ribbon, you go to the old ways, the old shamanic ways, and that is so wrong. That is not politically correct to say today, especially in Scandinavia, where the shamanistic way is has a
reemergence, resurgence,
and they are sort of very proud. They feel those who do the shamanistic things, they feel far superior to sort of the Christian path. And I have observed, I was in a shaman gathering north of Oslo, where actually a Danish shamaness came and showed Save, where she used elemental beings to kill other people. And we all accepted it. I didn't know what it was. We sat in a ring, it's called Save. And we sing, and this shamaness, she opened a portal. And I saw these two very ugly elemental beings sitting there. And she asked them, the public, we, which was influenced quite much by the Sami shamanism. And they said, oh, they are building some electric wires up there in the North Norway. And they are in the connection with the old holy place. Let us destroy this work. And then they sent them away. And then I said, this is terrible, because they are now on to destroy the work, and they can hurt the people, they and so on and so on. And they all thought this was so spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
And so good. And they didn't see these ugly elemental beings that they sent away on a killing mission. Was even a priest from the Norwegian church present who was interested in shamanism. And afterwards, this priest opened the church to Sami rituals. Well, that is, they don't have any clue of what they are working with. And yeah. That is the moral. They don't have any moral. You cannot ask elemental being to destroy something.
Yeah. I mean, it's one thing for indigenous people who have been working with their shamanistic tradition and know the beans, the pitfalls, and the ways that those the ritual and all that have been invaded over time to deal with it. And of course, not all of them are going to deal with it well either, but the spiritual world will show up for them in different, but the appropriation of it is, people don't have any, not only do they not have any clue, but they don't have the genuine connection often to even interpret, you know, the presence of the beings. And I gave a talk in London a couple months ago, and it came up somehow. It was at this occult bookstore, and someone asked me about magic. The guy who was interviewing me asked me about magic, and I said, you know, I realize this is not the best place to say this, but I think too many people are doing magic. I think we really shouldn't, we don't really need to do it anymore in the way that it used to be done. And a man raised his hand afterward and he said, you know, my daughter and I both practice magic for the environment, to help the environment. And, you know, we've been doing this witchcraft for a while, and I don't think we're hurting anybody. And I understood his objection, and I think also he might have heard my Christian framework as a kind of materialistic mainstream Christian framework, didn't understand where I was coming from. But I had to say, you know, I think a lot of times we think we're doing something good. That doesn't mean that we are, just because we've intellectualized a good result from our magic. It's the gesture that matters, you know, more and more. It's the gesture that matters, and it doesn't matter if they're sending the elemental beings out to destroy the power line. That also affects the elemental beings, and that also affects other people's access to them, you know, in the same way that people doing hallucinogenic drugs, psychedelic drugs now to access the spiritual kingdom. There are lots of problems with that, but one of them is that it alters the beings that you meet with those drugs as well. So it's also affecting the spiritual world. So even if you somehow save something in the material world or you create a good effect, the counter effect is a damage in the spiritual world.
And in my opinion, if you ask the elemental beings themselves, what they want a freedom. They want to be actually infused with a certain moral. You can ask them, and you can ask these people that you met to ask the elemental beings, what do you want? And then they actually want to be what Steiner called, he called it through Christianized elemental beings, or it is actually the meaning of the world, which is love, to create love. That is, they need love in them, and that is the moral aspect that they want, because then they can develop. So yeah. They ask too little the elemental beings. Ask next time. Ask them. Ask elemental beings what they want.
That is part of the. So that does bring us, I think, directly to Vidar and this idea of circulating nourishment. The Vidar's, I forget exactly, the presenter of Christ is how you refer to him, right? The presenter.
What do you call it in English? The nowadays presenter of the Christ force, yes.
Yeah, so there's this mediating or circulating aspect to Vidar where the encounter with him, in my experience, is this encounter of bringing the elemental kingdom and the human kingdom in Christ all into this redemptive relationship with each other through a kind of circulating, a real circulation, even our circulation system, the circulating movement. So maybe you can talk a little bit more about who Vidar is, I mean, look, you have, I'm not going to tell you, you don't have to report all your experiences with him because you have two books about that now, but maybe a little bit, you know.
Well, three now. It is one now under publishing.
Okay.
Not Vidar book, but in English, my English publisher, he said that he didn't want to publish more than one book a year. That has to do with the economy and sales, of course. Uh-huh. But the next is finished and is very soon being published in German.
Okay.
So, but you have to wait 1 year in English. and I don't dare to do anything because he's very, yeah. So, Vidar. Vidar is a very important figure or spirit or entity in both Rudolf Steiner's work and in the old Nordic spiritual hierarchy, because the Nordic people, North German people, they realized that all the gods were going to die in the meeting of the adversarial forces. But one is going to survive, and that is Vidar. And he will recreate the new spiritual experience, or give us the new spiritual experience. That is history. You can read about that in the Edda and in Steiner and in Sergei Prokofiev's book on Vidar. And he was called the silent god in 1,000 years ago when he had the level of an angel, but today he has the level of an archangel. And an archangel can speak. The angels are usually quiet, but the archangels speak. And now he has been set by the world of providence as the guardian of the threshold between the elemental world and the rest of the spiritual world. And this is very important, that you then meet him and respect him and stand there until he has taught you what you need to learn. And for me, that took about 15, 16 weeks, or I don't actually, maybe it was even more. And he taught me what I needed to learn. Others maybe will be taught other things, or maybe longer time, or maybe harder teaching, or I don't know. That is, I can only report my path there. So that is Vidar, an archangel who is very closely connected to Christ from very old time, from thousands of years ago, which now is a guardian of the threshold between the elemental world and the spiritual world. And this threshold has only been available or open during a very short time, because you had to open the elemental world before you can come to this threshold. Of course, high initiates or such people, they could always travel there, I guess. But they didn't speak about it. And Rudolf Steiner was very careful to speak about the deeper layers of the elemental world. But today it is open and sort of legal to travel. So now everybody can travel there.
They have the certificate with two marks on their health certificate to be able to go.
And those who and now I get more and more feedback that more and more people are able to go there after what I have been teaching them, how to go through the elemental world. So I'm very happy about that. But you have to then meet everybody, as I said, with respect, and especially Vidar. And then you must ask, okay, here I am. What must I learn? Mm-hmm. And you must have very patience. You must be patient. Mm-hmm. This is not a quick travel. You have to stand there for probably months and receive this teaching and take this teaching up. That is very important. I think if you dismiss some teaching because it doesn't fit in your work or your life or whatever, then I think it will be repeated in different ways until you accept it. It's like in school. If you in the fourth grade say that, no, I don't care about the multiplication. Okay, then you have to go to fourth grade again. No, I don't like that 4 multiplied by 4 is 16. I don't. Okay, then you just have to wait till you realize, okay, 4 multiplied by 4 is 16.
Mm.
And I think some people are so stubborn in their way of seeing life or reality that they don't want to see it. And then, okay, next life maybe.
I think another aspect of that for me, since I moved here, I've been very interested in, or interested in touch with St. Brendan in the Brendan Mysteries and Voyage, where in the 4th century BC or ED, he traveled from Ireland to America in a boat. And the story is, you know, it's not straightforward. First, he, I'm not going to get the order right, but he goes to an island where people are throwing fire. Then he goes to an island where these birds are talking to him in chimes. Then he goes onto the back of a whale, Jasconius, and stays there. And he has a small group of people with him. And they're all frightened, but he's just, you know, stays in his faith and connection with Christ. But the interesting thing is that he has to keep going. He'll go somewhere, but then he'll have to go back sometimes 2 or 3 times to an island that he's been to before. So you don't have a straight path from Ireland to America. You have this very long voyage where he'll go somewhere, then double back. He ends up on the back of the whale more than once even. And of course, they're terrified the first time they're on the whale. But then after that, it's not as frightening anymore when they have to go. And then eventually he gets there to America or wherever someone thinks that he's ended up. And then he goes back to Ireland with everything that he's gotten from being in this new place. And that for me, one is as we journey, you know, being okay with, not just okay, but realizing the enrichment that comes from the unknowingness, because every spiritual lesson makes me feel not prepared for the next spiritual lesson to come. It's actually, I still feel unequipped the next one that comes in. So I feel, if I feel I'm going back, I won't persist with the journey, but also I won't see the new thing that appears to me when I end up on the same island that I was just at a few months ago or whatever. But more than that, with this Vidar mystery and this circulating of the nourishment, the idea being for me that as we go through this unknowingness, as we retrace our steps, as we have to go back to the island to go forward again and then back and then forward again, we're creating a path and a form, and we're creating and we're giving and re-nourishing the places we've been to before we end up where we need to be. And so even as you're describing the stubbornness, if we can see our unknowingness and our setbacks and the returning to having no idea how to proceed as part of the task, then you realize that actually you're bringing the nourishment of the task to whatever you attend to. And, you know, that's one aspect of the Vidar and the Brendan, you know, mystery for sure, I think.
I think that story is very important, and it tells quite much because, you know, Steiner also talked about all this traveling to America, and also the Vikings here had ceremonies where they were rowing to America. They were not doing it physically, but they were doing it spiritually. I have even done that with the Sami people myself. And the Brendan, and he come to this island, go back, the whale and all this. I think, but everybody's going to America because that is deeper into the elemental world, the West. So I think all this has not to do with physical travel to the physical continent of America.
Right, yeah.
Because Steiner said that all the many traveled to America during the early Middle Ages, or, you know, and it was stopped for a period. But, and from Ireland, they traveled to America. And if so many had traveled to America during the 1,000 year before Columbus, why did, when Columbus physically came there, why did almost half of the Indians die from different virus or bacteria or diseases that they brought with them? And back to Europe, they brought also a lot of diseases and syphilis and new plants and new, you know. If they had had all this physical traveling, then some seeds would have, you know, they needed food for the travel back and forth. It would have been exchange of bacteria, virus, seeds, plants, potatoes, whatever. So I think more and more than that this was in the elemental world they were traveling. That, I know that is opposite to what very many think. But more and more facts tell me that it couldn't be physical. Why? Because we all carry virus and bacteria and all this. You know, why didn't we then bring diseases before Columbus? Why then suddenly them?
I mean, it may also be, do you think, perhaps the elemental kingdom itself was altered in relationship to the people who were traveling in the 15th century. I mean, their encounter with disease and the spiritual world was so altered that they would have brought something completely different at that point, you know, that would have affected people differently.
Well, so if you look at diseases here in Europe, it's been the same for thousands of years. You can see graves that say, oh, this had this disease, black plague in the 1300 and so on and so on.
But if it's Columbus, well, we don't, this, I think this is more of a personal conversation for us to have because very interesting. Okay. but I mean, maybe I'll just say like, we could go into it deeper at some point, but I think maybe it's just, you know, if Columbus, some of that voyage was about, not letting Muslims take over. It was the fear of a different empire. So they were trying to find different land. And the idea was to sort of move with a sense of conquest, with a sense of domination, absolutely there originally, that might have transformed the disease processes that they were bringing with them. But
there is one other thing also that is very interesting in this case. You see, according to Steiner, very many of the ships went from Norway to America. For hundreds of years, he said. Yeah. At that time, there was overpopulation in Norway. Yes. And the sons were moving higher and higher up in the mountains, and the farms got smaller and smaller, and it was very difficult to live in Norway at that time. There were too many people. Later, the Black Plague came and arranged that, no problem. They all died. But at that time, they had problems in feeding themselves. And if they were traveling from Norway to America, they pass a huge fertile country called Iceland. Mm-hmm. That is so close to the route that they have to see it. And on Iceland, there were huge pastures, there were trees, there were springs, there were hot springs, they were beautiful. But no one started to live there until 900. Mm-hmm. There are no signs of human activity there at all. So if they traveled back and forth, you know, with these ships in old times, mm-hmm. and then they come home and they say, there is a very nice country up there, just straight north of the trail, they would say that, and so many would go there. Mm-hmm. But nobody did. So you have that, and you have these diseases and the herbs and the weeds and everything, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, we let that stay. I think the traveling, you see, was in the spirit. Mm-hmm. They went there in the elemental, and what you describe, this traveling of this Irish monk, that is a traveling in the elemental world, mm-hmm. which was to the west. And then you reach this continent of America, which is sort of the home of the elemental forces.
Well, you bring up something, it's an interesting thing with the Iceland question, because Iceland and Ireland, and to some extent some parts of Norway, I would say as well, but definitely also some places in America, have a very distinct relationship to the elemental kingdom, where
absolutely.
Even people who are just total atheists, I mean, here in Ireland, you have someone, you know, who's an atheist that won't walk through a circle of mushrooms, you know, or you have the government, you know, in 1999, you know, they reroute their millions of euro road plan to avoid a fairy bush, you know. Yes. So there is something that is, there's a very special relationship here, where it lives on. And that's also true in Iceland, also true in some places in Norway, but also true in some places in America as well. They're very different. Ireland and Iceland, there's something similar. I mean, even it's almost the same word, which is funny to me, but the sun and ice, but the one in America is quite distinct in those places. So one, just to talk about a little bit of the sort of destiny of the elemental kingdom in America, I think. I have a little bit of a better handle on it in Ireland, just because I'm here so I can experience it. But most of my audience is in the U.S. So
where in Ireland do you live?
I'm in Dublin, so the least, okay. the least of it. But even here, even in the middle of the biggest city in this country, you feel it, you know?
Oh, yeah. I know.
So maybe we can talk about the destiny of the elemental kingdom in the U.S. because we're talking about moving that way, this sort of feeling. I mean, certainly the U.S. is experiencing a karmic reckoning right now. So,
what do you call it?
A karmic reckoning. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I just want to know where you see this, where you see the elemental kingdoms, you know, sort of destiny or redemption or whatever going there. Because I can talk about it here, but most of my listeners are in the U.S., so they'll be interested to know.
Well, the first thing that strikes you is traveling around the world. If you come to, let's say, the Middle East, you come to Australia, you come to America, you come to Iceland, Ireland, Scandinavia, South America, the elemental beings are very, very different. Mm-hmm. They are very different. And they are, elemental beings are quite much racists. I saw that in, we had a shaman gathering up in Norway, and a Norwegian shaman, he called forth the elemental beings of the forest. They were quite small and very pleasant. They were quite kind. And then he had they had invited a shaman from South America. And he called forth a huge anaconda. That was the shape of their elemental beings, or the one he used. And the Norwegian elemental beings, they were terrified. They fled. So when you, so they are very, very different, and they not don't necessarily mingle very easily. So when you come to America, the elemental beings are totally different from the ones in Scandinavia. They are much bigger. They are much stronger. And they, that is quite a funny thing, they are hairy, and they don't wear clothes. While the elemental beings in Norway, they are not hairy, and they wear clothes. Why this is so, I have no idea. But many Americans, they have seen these elemental beings, and they called him Bigfoot. And that is an elemental being. Mm-hmm. And there are hundreds of them in America. I gave a lecture up at Spring Valley, and there were hundreds of elemental beings gathering to listen to the lecture because they are so longing for people to recognize them and to be acknowledged. In Iceland, they are also very different from the Scandinavians. In Ireland, they are not that different. They are bigger. The smallest one are in Scandinavia. That maybe has to do with the power or strength that I do not know. But the Americans, they are, let's say, 2 meters high. And the Norwegians, they are... Now I talk about the gnomes. That is the first thing you often meet. And... And the, in Norway, they are only, let's say, half meter. So when you meet them, you have to, as I said, be very accept them, their existence, and be pay respect to them. And then you start a conversation with them. You ask them things, what do you want? More like what you want. And what they want is to be like... There is a Danish fairy tale about a little mermaid, H.C. Andersen, and she wanted to be human. She wanted to get a soul. And this is very true. They want to be ensouled. They get a moral or a love, or a Christ force, you might say. So then you can actually give them that. If you meet them, you can actually open their middle for a love force, for a Christ force. And then they are so happy.
So, a few things. One, I think people are surprised to hear you talk about, you know, these beings as that specifically sort of familiar. So, you know, if it's one thing to tell people about, you know, elemental beings or whatever, but if I talk about a leprechaun wearing its little hat and its little shorts, you know, people, I mean, that the reflexive rejection of that, I think, yeah, is very strong. So one, I think it's just important to maybe talk about why they appear to some people in that way that seems so, I don't know, easily dismissible. But then two, just to add one more part to this, you're not, and this is just for the listeners, you're not talking about all elemental beings, because obviously when we talk about the beings connected to flowers or certain elemental forces, they don't all look like Bigfoots in America, right?
No.
Just to clarify that, when you say, when you see the elemental beings, what you're talking about is elemental beings that express an aspect or are appearing as an aspect of forces in that geographical region.
Yeah. The first, I can only speak for myself again, the first elemental beings I meet is those who are related to the earth of that area.
Mm-hmm.
And that are sort of gnomish elemental beings.
Mm-hmm.
They are, and if you read books and if you read stories and all this, that is what people usually meet first,
mm-hmm.
the gnomes. Then you can go on further to meet the elemental beings of the water, of the air, of the fire, and you can go deeper into the second elemental realm, meet the elemental beings of the atoms and the molecules and so on. But what you usually meet first, and that is important to know, I think, and that is actually the elemental beings of that area related to mostly the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And you said they are experienced differently by different. They are actually not experienced that different.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in America who see a Bigfoot, they describe it as a Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm.
They do. The descriptions are very similar. And that is the first they meet. Hunters have met a Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm.
And they have not met a flower fairy or a tree elemental beings and so on, because then they would have understood that Bigfoot is not a physical being.
Mm-hmm.
So still, that is what I describe. And as in Norway, where the first elemental beings you meet, they do have a little cap. They do.
It's so funny because when people accept that when you talk about aliens, right? Like people would say, oh, the aliens look like this. They would say, exactly. But when you start talking about spiritual beings as looking a certain way, people have such a resistance to it, you know.
That's true. That's a very good point.
Yeah. As we kind of wrap up here, I want to maybe go into the darkness a little bit with you before we end. I think, you know, when you're talking right at the beginning about redeeming the Luciferic and Ahrimanic and Asuric forces, you know, the Ahrimanic forces, they're quite difficult, but you can see that it's not love, but it's something that looks like love to Ahriman. I give you eternal life. I give you, nourishment, pleasure all the time, you know, but it's all, you know, obviously as below, so above. It's all just completely non-spiritual. So it seems like, okay, I understand how to deal with that. I understand how to deal with creating a heart for Ahriman. It actually doesn't have a heart. It's like the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz. Like, it needs to have the heart built for it through our actions. Yes. Sorry, say?
Yeah, they want the heart. The Tin Man wants the heart.
Yes, exactly. And maybe Ahriman's not exactly in a human sense connected to the want or to the desire for the heart, but there's something in its movement that shows us what it needs. So we can do that. We can take up that work. And I think as we do that, as we come to understanding how to relate to Ahriman, that will give us the insight onto how to redeem the Asuric powers. And I think that because we have largely not done that yet. That's why the Asuric power, the Asuric being, seems so distant from our ability to relate to them. But I just want to say that before even talking about the Asuric beings at all, because it gets so dark and frightening for people to encounter this evil, and even myself to talk about it. I can feel it. The proximity of it does not feel good. So just to remind myself, it'll be okay. We can manage it. I just don't have the knowledge or understanding yet. But the Asuric beings, when you say that they show up now, and you are marking that as the encounter with the vacuum or something, you say, has happened recently. And in fact, happened right around the first time you and I talked, just a little after that, I think. Not because you and I talked, but just a little bit after that. And so we talk about their presence and what they are a little bit, and then maybe just to end with the image of redeeming them somehow.
Yeah. You know, we have been used to the Luciferic elementals for a long time. Mm-hmm. And for a certain time, the Arimanic. So the Luciferic beings, you see, the most typical with the adversarial forces is that they lie. They give wrong hallucinations, they give wrong ideas, they give wrong conceptions, and they give different wrong. For example, the Luciferic, when I have a patient, I ask this patient sometimes, because I see there is an elemental being, I'm not really sure what it is. After a while, you get more and more sure, of course. But in the beginning, I ask then the patient to lie a Luciferic lie. Mm. That means if you would say that you are a young, beautiful girl, then the Luciferic elemental grows. Mm. So if I say I'm strong and young, you know, it's the Luciferic, and I really mean it. If you then say that 2 + 2 = 5, that is an Arimanic lie. Mm. And then the Arimanic being grows. And that was until 2019. It was only these two present. And then the elemental world where the Asuric beings opened. And then another lie sort of emerged. And that is the lie that is universal, because the Asuric being are related to the archaic forces. Mm-hmm. And the Arimanic to the archangelic forces, and the Luciferic to the angelic. Angelic is personal. Mm-hmm. Archangelic, they are groups of people. So here, a group of people, of course, we say that mathematics is correct. 2 + 2 = 4. And then we have the Asuric lies, which has to do with sort of universal lies. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning, and now I will, of course, provocate quite many who listen. I said, say that the earth is flat. Mm-hmm. And then the Asuric demonic forces grew. Mm-hmm. That is, there are some people who actually believe it, and they actually do believe it.
Yeah.
But when I look at these people, I see that their Asuric part is stronger than normal. Mm-hmm. That is why they believe it. So that gives rise to all this today. We have to acknowledge that there are sort of loss of reality sense in many people. They start to believe in lies.
Yeah. Can I just say something about that real quickly before you go on? Because I think there's a conjunction between the Asuric and the Ahrimanic there, which I find really interesting, because we talk about the conjunction of Lucifer and Ahriman a lot. Yeah. But the people who say the earth is flat, the truth in that, or the reason they say that, is because they are seeing that the lie in science that is say that says we have all the information, we have the research, we have the data, so your experience doesn't matter. So when people who say the earth is flat say, but it, they're rebelling in a way by saying my experience actually needs to be brought into bear in the picture of reality, but it becomes amplified by their ego. So then they say the earth is flat because my experience matters even more than any of the information that we've gathered. So that's a conjunction of the Asuric forces and the Ahrimanic forces.
Totally right. Because when I watch clairvoyantly a person that has these sort of wrong universal ideas, the Asuric and the Ahrimanic, they are joined together. Mm-hmm. The Ahrimanic is in this way and the Asuric is in this way. Mm-hmm. So they are sort of penetrating into the surroundings a special way. For example, a friend of mine, he is a doctor in Norway, anthroposophic doctor, and he has got the idea that that in every COVID vaccine there is a little computer that so everybody who get a vaccination are surveilled by some groups of people. Okay, there are some people who believe that. Uh-huh. And now comes the interesting thing. His wife realized that he was crazy, so she actually threw him out. So he hired a house up in the country, and one evening he stood at his veranda, and he was then convinced that the producer of the vaccines would kill him because he was revealing the truth. So he saw a car with three professional hitmen drive up in his garden. They got out with each their rifle, and he was standing quietly on the veranda, and they tried to shoot him. But they missed. So the bullets went into the wall behind him, and then they disappeared. And he told this in a public lecture in Oslo. And then he looked at the wall, and it was strange because there were no holes. I mean, he saw everything. Mm-hmm. How plausible is that three professional hitmen with rifles stand 20 meters away from you and they all miss?
That drove to you and you were alone? Yeah, yeah.
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 You would not be dead if it was true.
Yeah.
So, and this is so typical. And he just held a lecture for many people in Oslo about this. How this big pharma tried to kill him because he knew the secret of the vaccines, but he was protected by the gods, and you know.
And the opposite. The protection was in the vision. Anyway, sorry. We know what that is. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That is actually an act of the Asuric beings.
Uh huh. Yes.
They gave him the hallucinations, and that is quite interesting because the COVID disease itself is governed by Asuric forces. You look at the elemental being of the Asuric disease, it is Asuric. Mm. Of the COVID disease is Asuric. And now I also heard that from a doctor I know that very many who get this COVID, they get hallucinations. They see things that is not true. And this is, Andrew Steiner said that Ahriman is going to start a school in clairvoyance when he incarnates. And I think that is in this progression, because when the Asuric beings will become more and more prominent, more and more people will see things clairvoyantly. Mm-hmm. But it is false. Steiner said that this school of Ahriman will... that everybody see different realities. Nobody agree. And that leads to war of all against all in the end.
And in physical pictures, they'll see it. So they won't be spiritual pictures. They'll be physical pictures in the clairvoyance. Yeah.
Yeah. They really believe it. They see it. It's like this. And then it's impossible to argue. Because he saw pre-hitman shoot him. I cannot say he didn't. Of course, I saw it. I stood there. Were you there? No, but it's not thinkable that they all missed. Yeah, they did. You know, so this makes it very difficult. Mm. The influx of the Asuric beings today.
Mm.
And quite funny and interesting.
Yeah.
I find it funny.
Well, I mean, the thing with the hitman as well is, look, I mean, those could be, you know, the opportunity there is that the spiritual world, the Asuric had kind of given itself away as well, in a way. So there's an opportunity there for him to see, wow, three, first of all, which is interesting, shot at me, then they all missed. And that was illusory. So what I'm being shown is my own ego, that somehow I, the anthroposophical doctor, has evoked, who's moved out into the country, has evoked, you know, the wrath of some conspiratorial whatever to come out and get me. He could have read, with the ability to read, oh, actually what I'm being shown here is, you know, that this is not true. But, and so I think that this is something, when I think about overcoming the Asuric forces, there's something like this, because when we think about Christ going to the center of the earth, there wasn't a battle. It was an observance of the being, and then a moving away from the being, not engaging in what was showing. I don't know that that's enough to overcome or redeem or bring love to these beings, but there is an aspect of the beings where I think, in a weird way, because they're in thinking, and thoughts are sealed off. Thinking is open, but thoughts are sealed off. They want to be just observed, but not entered into. And I think that there's some aspect like that, because they're sealed and they need observation. So there's another component, but I don't know what it is yet, but that has something to do with overcoming them. Because what he saw could have been very helpful.
Yeah, the first thing is actually to be aware of them and how they work.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can try to fuse this Christ force into them, and then they can be transformed.
Yeah. Whereas I think, I mean, we need to bring, you know, awareness to all Luciferic or harmonic beings, all that kind of stuff too. But we can enter into them a lot more easily because they're open to us, and they're seeking to engage with us in a certain way too. And the Asuric beings are, I don't know, there's something about them that's sealed in a way. I'll think about it more. Well, I'll figure out how to deal with the Asuric beings by the next time we talk.
then you tell me.
One last thing about Vidar here that I just want your thoughts on. You know, Hitler's advisors, spiritual advisors, would often talk about, and inspirers would talk about Baldur and the Norse gods and all that. So do you worry about the sort of interception or invasion of that stream into the Northern initiation path, that it's been intersected by those forces sometimes? And how do we wade through that as we go forward with this path for the people who are called onto it?
What I am worried about is the shamanistic traditions. I am not actually worried about the black magic people.
Mm.
They are too few. And I'm not worried about the shamanistic stream. I just am worried about them. I don't think they don't go to that path, that Vidar threshold, because when they come there, they will meet Christ, mm-hmm. and then there is no problem.
It just, it's a question of how long, right? Because there's that question, you know, that story about Alexander von Bernis's daughter, right? Ulla von Bernis, who practiced black magic her whole life, but then sees Christ at the end of her life. It says, in the end, I will conquer all. And then she just gives it up. So it's not a question of will they find it.
She should have seen it before, you know, a life thrown away. And probably you have to redeem quite much what you have done next life too. So it will take 2 or 3 more lives.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be nice if it happened more quickly for people, but that's how it goes sometimes, I suppose.
Oh, it is like that. It is like that. You have actually to be self-aware and criticize yourself. Is this right or not? If you go on the wrong direction, you can go there all around the world, you know, the wrong direction. You have actually to clear thinking, sort of clear self-criticism. Clear self-criticism is important. There, you need a certain ability to see your own stupidity. That is for all life. If you start to mingle with, let's say, drug addicts, then you are probably dead within some time. If you start with criminals, you are probably in, let's say, in New York, you go into criminal gangs, you are probably dead in 3 years. And so on. You have to, and they know it, but they sort of don't know it either. They think they can survive, but they have to realize this is not a place to stay. So I don't understand sometimes, of course, but that is how in the spiritual too, you have to see, you have to ask yourself every time, is this right? Is this an hallucination? Is this from the adversarial forces? Or is this where I should go? You have to ask yourself all the time. And one problem with especially the New Age people is that they do not differ very often between adversarial forces and beneficial forces.
Right.
They see a spiritual phenomenon and they say, wow, this is spirituality. And they go on with that. And don't question if this maybe is the adversarial spirituality.
Yeah. The only thing with the New Age and self-help people that I think is, you know, when I think about them in comparison to people who are doing chaos magic or other kinds of magic, at least in the self-help spiritual development, there's a refinement of the person or the refinement of the morality piece that at least is there. I'm not saying everybody employs it, but it can be in there and available to people in a way that I think can safeguard them from some of the worst, but not always. I mean, obviously there are people in that movement. And of course, some of the people that walk that path of criminality and drug addiction, they get out, and then what they're able to do is help other people who are on that path, and not just help the people, but help the path itself and change the path. And that's, I mean, you know, but so I like that you describe it as look at yourself and look on the path, because you know where this path leads. You know, especially if you have some spiritual understanding, that the being that you're being walked with and to. I'm just very thankful to talk with you again. It's nice to see you. Thank you so much, Ari Thorsen, for coming on the show again. It's great to talk with you. Thank you.
So this is a real crash course. Do not look to these things that I'm saying now as like real and great definitions, but just real crash course definitions. So one of the terms that keeps coming up is elementals. Now, I think maybe some of you have an idea of elementals in fairy tales or whatever. We can think of, you know, little beings that hang out near flowers or in the water or, you know, in fire, whatever. That is one kind of elemental, but elementals as sort of depicted a bit more in a more detailed way, are just beings that rise out of human behavior, thoughts, and actions and feelings. And so everything we do kind of casts off an elemental. That's the concept that we're working with. And there are different versions of what's kind of cast off. So these entities show up as a direct result of human activity. When we talk about elementals, I just want you to think about that. If you want a deeper explanation of that, if you listen to Against Everyone with Connor Habib 67 with Daniel Joseph, that we go a lot more into the concept. The other concept that comes up a lot is Lucifer and Ahriman. Now, this is a sort of a description of two beings or principles that come up in anthroposophy, which is an approach to being human developed by the late 19th, early 20th century mystic, philosopher, scientist, architect, blah, 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 Rudolf Steiner, who also comes up on the show a lot. Lucifer and Ahriman, I'm not going to go too much into them here, but basically, Lucifer is kind of the new age impulse to leave the earth, to think that everything's just like light and energy and, you know, there's no need to engage with the struggles of the world. Ahriman is the sort of opposite impulse, which is everything is kind of microscopic, scientistic, completely material. You know, Ahriman is like the kind of impulse of, well, you know, love is just chemicals and, you know, motions of the brain and we're just biological robots, that kind of thing. So when we talk about them, we talk about them as beings, but you can also think of them as, or maybe if you're new to them, think of them as principles. This kind of new agey, leave the earth, everything's love and light principle versus this condensed, everything is just materialism, everything is just matter and motion. And so when we talk about Christ, because Are is a Christian esotericist, and that's where anthroposophy is deeply related to Christian impulses, but in such a way that it wouldn't even be recognizable, I think, to some people who call themselves Christians today. Christ is a kind of a third way that evades and balances out those other two impulses. This will all make sense when you listen. Finally, three words that you've heard many times in your life, but mean something different. Thinking, feeling, and willing. Thinking, feeling, and willing are three activities of being human that are really essential for esoteric practice and understanding. So we don't just mean thinking, feeling, and willing in the standard sense, but thinking, feeling, and willing as a kind of like a goal, something to understand in our esoteric work, in our spiritual work, in our spiritual development. The dynamic process of thinking, not thoughts, but the process of thinking itself, the current of thinking. Feeling, the moods that arise in us, these unfinished states that almost come like weather within us. Willing, like when we extend our being into behavior, into action. So these are really important in this discussion because we talk about separating them out from each other. Because right now they're really entangled in all of us. How do we separate them from each other and see them, on their own and strengthen them on their own and then maybe bring them back together?